Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast, coming from Dallas, Texas, Los Angeles, and Sacramento, California. Here's Skylar Teo, Aaron Alvarado, and David Stauffer.
Welcome to the Brave Little Podcast. Joining me all the way from a city without a Confederate monument, Dallas, Texas, Skylar Teo. Skylar, dude, what's up?
Oh, the monument is still up currently.
Oh, it is.
But we have promises from at least 8 of the city council members to vote to take it down as soon as the vote comes up.
8 out of how many?
In Dallas, we have 14 city council members and a mayor. Mayor only gets one vote. It's a weak mayor system. And so that is enough. That's the majority.
So and 8 out of the 14?
8 out of the 14 plus.
Okay, so I think what's up with
the mayor? The mayor will vote 1 with the winning side because that's kind of his bit because he loves being the winner. He's kind of a whatever. Mike Rollins, great guy. I love his son. Good people if they're listening. I know his son's listened a few times, but anyway, good people.
Great people.
Great people. But yes, it's going away. They came out with a number today of how much it's going to cost because I think they're trying to freak people out. But they said 1.8 million, which I think is way high.
Tell them you'll do it for 500k.
I'm looking at 200k to do the job.
Okay, yeah, I was gonna say, yeah.
And, honestly, you do it for 100 bucks. No, I think that number will come down.
Imagine if Kara comes home one day and there's just this Confederate monument just like crunched in your apartment, just like in the corner, because you just had nowhere to put it.
Yeah, it's not gonna happen.
Yeah, how tall is it?
It's 60 feet tall.
Oh, that's really tall. That's pretty tall.
But.
Well,
yeah, a lot of reasons.
We don't want to talk about Confederate monuments, though the Brave Little Podcast is on record that we are against all monuments. Confederate Union, take them all down. Just kidding. Just the Confederate ones. But speaking of monuments, Kyrie Irving and Isaiah Thomas. So... Yeah,
no, not Kyrie's best. Not going to get a monument in Cleveland anymore. He could have stayed
exactly,
his whole career.
Exactly. But. Speaking of monuments, the Quickie Loan Center, whatever it's called, arena, is not going to have a Kyrie monument because he wanted out of that city. And the news broke just a few hours before recording this podcast. Kyrie to Boston, Isaiah to Cleveland. What was your gut reaction to this?
I was... pretty shocked. It's not often you get all-star for all-star in the same conference in a trade like this. Like, this is pretty crazy, especially because Cleveland's getting an all-star plus a future all-star and a number one overall pick, which it'll probably be at least a top three pick. It's a weird trade because I honestly don't know if Isaiah helps Cleveland win now any more than Kyrie does. But I also feel like Cleveland's about to lose LeBron.
Yeah.
And they're about to be terrible. And having a number one overall pick will definitely be a great way to start building that. Honestly, if I was Cleveland, I would shop this pick so hard and and get like a series of number ones over the next couple of years because you're going to stink next year. Do like the whole Cleveland plan where you just get as many number one overall picks as you can get and go from there.
So you bring up a good point here. A lot of this is clouded by the fact that LeBron is definitely leaving Cleveland after this season. And Isaiah is also definitely leaving Cleveland. And so we only have really one season to see how this shakes out. And it's going to be fascinating. I'm a big Isaiah fan. He's, you know, friend of the pod, follows me on Twitter. So, you know, I am biased here, given that I'm in his inner circle. But I think Isaiah Thomas is a better basketball player than Kyrie Irving. I wouldn't say leaps and bounds, but I would say that he fits the kind of Boston fan mentality and community in a way that I don't think Kyrie Irving will, which I think will be an interesting development to see how that shakes out, especially with the arrival of Gordon Hayward. But just flat out, Cleveland won this trade. Because not just because I think Isaiah is better than Kyrie, but because they got that Brooklyn first and they got Crowder, who in his own right is, you know, a good basketball player.
He slipped a lot this last season, but yeah.
Yeah, but he's still a good basketball player. I mean, he will be a contributing member of that basketball team. Not like the other guy in the trade, Zazic, or is that? I don't know. I honestly didn't know that.
They got Zaza Pachulia back, right?
No, yeah, not Zaza. But this is great. I mean, this changes the landscape of the East. Now, the question is Boston Worlds better with Kyrie instead of Isaiah in that spot?
The answer, I think, is no.
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure how good is Boston. Like, is Gordon Hayward that good? Because I'm not sure Gordon Hayward's that good.
I'm not sure either.
Like, I'm not a Gordon Hayward believer. I think that Utah's magic the last couple of years, like the reason they were as good as they were, had a lot more to do with who was playing center than who was playing their three. And so I actually think Utah's going to be better this year than people think they will be. I think
I agree with that. I definitely agree with that.
Playoff spot, which I think will piss off Gordon Hayward.
I think I like Gordon more than you. I do think he's overrated, especially with all the shenanigans and how he had one of the most epic botchings of a free agent signing or leaving since LeBron.
That was so annoying.
That was really bad. And it was such a bad look. And he lied. And his agent lied. And it's just terrible. But I think he's a good basketball player. I don't think he is a top 20 player in the league. Top 20? Top 25? Yeah, I don't think he's a top 25 player. Man, maybe even 30. I'd have to look at the list. But the fact is, I think he was greatly benefited by not just Rudy Gobert. I think he was benefited by a coach and a system that, you know, helped him tremendously. And a haircut that he'll have to lose soon for obvious reasons. But, I don't think Boston is... I don't think it's a slam dunk for them. And not just because they lost that pick. I don't think it's a slam dunk because I don't know how Kyrie's going to fit in there. Like, there are definitely skills that Kyrie has that are, you know, better than Isaiah. But I just don't know that that's the type of, like, where his strengths are over Isaiah. Like, I just don't know if those are the types of things that are going to help that Celtics team, like, tremendously. I really don't. But seeing Isaiah and LeBron play for a season is going to be so interesting. They just released the schedule. I have my season tickets here in Sacramento, and I'm, like, pumped. There's only one date in Sacramento that Cleveland comes and only one date that Boston comes. I'll be going to those games for sure. A lot of Golden State dates, by the way. That's because they're, like, an hour down the road. But anyway, just mind-blowing that this is happening. Like, rarely do we see, to your point, like, a trade like that, like a straight-up all-star for all-star, you know, and some change. But like two bona fide all-stars in a swap like this that changes the landscape of a conference. Granted, a very weak conference to the far superior West.
Yeah, like it kind of feels like Game of Thrones.
Oh, yeah.
Where all these things are happening, like Cersei's wheeling and dealing and Jaime and all this is happening. But it also feels inevitable because the Whites are out there in Golden State ready to just come and kill everyone. And so like... Even what the Rockets have done or, like, every other move that's happened in the league feels pointless because I'm 99% sure the Golden State Warriors are going to repeat.
My analogy was going to be, like, Cersei is playing these games of politics with the whole, like, Tommen and whatever, that Margaery, and then the that religious, what's the religious figures guy?
The Sparrow.
The High Sept, or High Sparrow? High Septon, whatever.
He was a Sparrow, yeah, High Sparrow.
High Sparrow. Okay, so they're having their own little conflicts there, and they're wheeling a deal. But really, they're on the other side of that world. There's a woman with some dragons. Okay, so it's like doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Dragons are just going to come in and destroy whoever wins that conference.
Because winter is coming, and I think the Whites are going to win in the end.
I hope not.
Why?
I mean,
are they less deserving of victory? Than
Well, it's the privilege.
These terrible humans.
Yeah. I mean, zombie privilege.
Zombie privilege.
Are you bummed that the new episode hasn't leaked yet?
No, because Sundays are way more fun when you get to watch an episode.
I agree. Okay, so that's enough NBA talk. We know the Brave.
Golden State Warriors are going to win a championship. Write it down. Bet on it. Like, put all the money you have on the fact that the Warriors are going to win a championship.
Oh wow! I didn't expect you to say that.
Oh, of course. It's the season's already over.
Okay, so you can hate them, but at least admit that they're dominant.
No, I hate them because they're dominant. Like, it doesn't make the NBA fun when a team wins 16 of their 17 playoff games. Like, that's stupid to me because there's no competition. They're so much better than everybody else that there's no competition. And maybe there's something cool about that, but there's also something that's really uncompetitive and not very fun about that.
I mean, as a, if I were a general NBA fan, I mean, I guess that makes sense. If I had like zero rooting interest. But like, yeah, I don't know.
You got 31 teams that have no chance at winning a championship this year.
It's always like that, though. I mean,
no, it's not. You normally have like five teams.
Maybe to not this extent. But even then, I don't even want to give you that much of the argument. We've had the Bulls era. We had the Lakers. We had the Spurs. And then you have these random like little upstarts.
Yeah, but
like
the Spurs have never won back-to-back titles.
And the
Mavericks.
And you know, like you have these random championships. But ultimately, look, the history of the NBA is dynasties. People dominating. Like that's just what it is.
But that's what free agency was supposed to stop. That's the crazy thing. Is like you have once-in-a-lifetime talents like Michael Jordan that come along, and whenever he was in the finals for the last six years of his career, he won titles.
Right.
But Steph Curry is not that. Steph Curry is not a transcendent talent. What of course he does is he has Kevin Durant.
Unanimous MVP, of course.
Steph Curry is not even the best player on his team anymore.
Just absolutely historically good NBA player. Stop.
He's not.
That's ridiculous.
Even the best player on his team anymore.
That's ridiculous. He brings on another superstar and is able to adapt his style and win and still win a championship. I mean, the guy is a great,
an all-time what a hardship great to take a former player. MVP.
One of the greatest shooters, the greatest shooter to ever play the game. The greatest shooter.
I mean, he's still like on year eight. We'll see when he's done his career. But it's just, it's such, and you know what? The Bulls never won 16-17.
They won 72 games in a season. That's
and the Warriors won 73, bro.
I know, because they're better, even better. But it's still a comparable level of dominance.
No, it's like they're going to win six titles over the next like 8 years or over like the 8 year period. They should be at three in a row right now if it wasn't for the miracle of Kyrie Irving.
It's this funny thing about me being a Kings fan here. You know, I obviously there's proximity to the Bay Area.
You're a fake Kings fan.
I was born in the Bay Area. That's where I'm from originally. I was just a little kid, a baby when I moved to Sacramento. But like my dad's in the Bay Area. He's a Warriors fan. Like I've always, certainly rooted for the Warriors as my second favorite team, even when they were crappy. But there is this weird level of like, they're so good that I'm like really bashful about admitting that I like them because I have a number one team and it's Sacramento, who happened to be spectacularly bad. And so it's this awkward thing where it's like, it's bad for optics for me to speak positively about the Warriors because it really reeks of bandwagonry. But I will, you and Aaron famously just like, you know, hate the Warriors. And I obviously like them. But I will say, since moving back to Sacramento, the amount of Golden State Warriors gear that I see in this city, granted, our proximity to the Bay Area, you know, downtown Sacramento is just an hour outside of the Bay Area, where, you know, what you'd consider the Bay Area. A lot of people in Sacramento have roots there. Combine that with the people that are just going to be bandwagon fans. And it outrages me how much more Warrior stuff I see than King stuff. You know, you still have a lot of King stuff, a lot of diehard fans, but there's so much Warrior stuff that like I'm starting to turn a little bit. I'm starting to turn and kind of go like a little anti. But I don't know. I can't give you and Aaron that satisfaction. Can't do it.
Yeah, just stay hard with them. It's just like I went to a Mavs Warriors game two seasons ago in the 73 win year. And I got there early, and it was like 800 kids under the age of 12, each one of them wearing a Steph Curry jersey.
Well, that's weird. He's not a transcendent talent. Why would they be doing that?
No, it's because they look like him. And they're all cheering for this one guy, and every single one of them is from Dallas. They're not like transplants. They're like kids who should be Dallas Mavericks fans. But their parents have led them astray to thinking that the way to cheer for NBA teams is to find the most popular player in the world and cheer for that guy. And, like, I had friends who were big Bulls fans in the 90s, and I just think it's a wrong way to follow sports. Like, I guess each their own, but like, that's not for me.
In the words of Sacramento native and former Daily Show correspondent Hasan Minhaj, you stick and you pick. Nope, you pick and you stick.
Like, I mean, if you don't live in a city that has a team, we can talk about what you're doing. Like, Aaron picked the Cowboys, and that's an okay thing to do because he was in L.A., and L.A. didn't have a team. And
they're America's team.
And it's, you're right.
I hate saying that.
You're very right about that. But I'm not a fan of people from different cities. Like, honestly, if I move and Eleanor decides she's like a fan of the city I moved to, like I wouldn't blame her, because I think you gotta support the city you're in. Like, I'm not even a big fan of, like, supporting the city your parents are from. Like, I have a buddy who lives here. He's lived here his whole life.
Yeah.
But he's all Chicago fans because his parents, his dad's from Chicago. And so his dad raised him as a White Sox fan and a Bears fan. And just like, dude, if you live in Dallas, you got to be a Mavs fan. You got to be a Cowboys fan. You got to be a Rangers fan.
Look, my sister lives in Dallas, right? I mean, she's just in a north suburb.
She's a big Allen Eagles fan. That's all. Yeah,
she wrote the high school fight song that will stand the history of that high school. She has this huge banner at their stadium, their state-of-the-art stadium.
so stupid how much money they put in that stadium.
But yeah, by the way, I'm not going to be able to be there, but I was going to fly out for the home opener because they're bringing her out to the 50-yard
line. You're not
having
coming?
The whole arena do the fight song together.
Right.
You're and not honor coming? Her as the author.
Get out here.
I wish. I'm going to be in New Orleans, unfortunately. So
why are you going to be in New Orleans?
For work.
You can't even make it out. That's a drive. Just drive in and drive back.
I wish, dude. Anyway, so my sister, my brother-in-law are Giants fans. Well, my brother-in-law is a Giants fan. My sister, like myself, is an A's fan. But like they take my nephew
answer.
Parker and my other nephews and niece. They'll take them to the Ranger games when the Giants are in town. You know, and my brother-in-law wears his Giants gear, a hat, his Buster Posey jersey or whatever. And then recently, Parker, he's 10 years old, asked Greg, his dad, if he could start wearing some Rangers gear.
That's a good move.
And you know what? Greg's going to let him because he's lived in Dallas longer than he's lived in California.
Right. And you got to let the kid assimilate at school, too.
Like, exactly.
It's more fun to have friends who are the fans of the team you cheer for.
It's like, the dads who like force their kids to root for the team of their upbringing, even though they live somewhere else, those kids don't do well.
It's a bad bit.
It's a bad bit.
And, like, they can keep cheering for that team, but they also need to adopt that city they're in to a certain degree. Like, have an AL-NL team. Like, I get if you're an A's fan, being a Rangers part-time fan doesn't work, but if you're a Giants fan, you can definitely be a part-time Cowboys fan or Rangers fan.
That's
a lot more sports than we thought we were going to do. But
yeah, Greg, my brother-in-law, by the way, talks about how, like, every radio station is talking about the Dallas Cowboys. Like, everything is sports talk, and it's all Cowboys.
That's accurate.
And he says that it's so much, it permeates like just content everywhere, like just Cowboys, 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 to the point that like, you know, he finds himself kind of soaking in information and details about the Cowboys seasons, like the smallest bits of detail that he never would have thought about. And he's not a Cowboys fan.
But man, I'll tell you this, like during Cowboys season on Mondays after a loss, there is a collective, like you go to a gas station.
It's a cloud.
Everybody's bummed.
Yeah.
Like you go, if you work in a big place, like everyone's down. Like it is, the city feeds off the Cowboys, which is funny because like I'm a way bigger Mavs fan, even a bigger Rangers fan than I'm a Cowboys fan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that probably is due to the fact that LeBron James is a Cowboys fan. Like just the fact that everyone and their dog is a Cowboys fan kind of bums me out about them.
Yeah.
Plus I can't stand Jerry Jones, but
you've got to love him and hate him. Both, right? I mean,
yeah, but I mean, like, I still cheer for them. Like, that's the thing is, I'd kind of like to not be a Cowboys fan just because there's so many things about them that I hate, like Jerry Jones. But at the end of the day, I freaking love the Cowboys. Like, I just love watching their games. But like, I'm so much more excited for the Mavericks. Like, I don't know if you saw, but they polled all the rookies this week on who's going to be Rookie of the Year this season. The rookies' consensus was that Dennis Smith Jr. will be Rookie of the Year, despite being the ninth pick.
There's no greater projection of how a rookie's going to do in an NBA regular season than the summer league.
Yeah, you know what's crazy is last season, the rookies picked Bogdan Bogdanovic, despite him being the 40th pick. They knew he was going to be rookie of the year because the class is going to be so bad. Oh, wait, that didn't happen.
I give you a hard time. Obviously, Dennis Smith looked good in Vegas summer league, but coming from a Kings fan,
and he looked great in college.
I've spent so many hours watching Summer League footage over the last...
This is my first time to ever watch Summer League, ever.
For the past 11 years, back to back. And, dude, we even won the Summer League one year. It was such an exciting year, and we had our worst record yet in the regular season. So it means nothing.
I'll tell you why I think he actually does have a legit chance of winning Rookie of the Year. And it's because of the situation he's coming into, where he's going to be the starting point guard for 82 games on a team that's competent. Like a team that has Nerlens Noel, a team that has Harrison Barnes.
Coach.
Harrison Barnes, a top five coach in the NBA.
Yeah, yeah.
Dirk Nowitzki, a Hall of Famer, who will not be playing a ton, but sure. He'll be there in the gym with them.
They'll lose a lot of games, but...
They're going to lose a lot of games, but he's going to average like 20 points a game.
Yeah,
that's And he's going to dunk a ton. Like, he's going to be on SportsCenter a ton. Like, he's going to be a really interesting player on this team. And I think that will add up to being Rookie of the Year.
Because
I think Lonzo's not going to start. I don't think your boy De'Aaron's definitely not starting. So they're going to be playing like 20 minutes a game, averaging like 10 points a game, which that might end up being great for them. Like in two seasons, they'll probably be awesome. But so this season, we're going to have a lot more chances with DSJ.
I'll say with this, like the Kings, and they in a vacuum, I loved the George Hill signing at the price that they got it at. What I don't love is that it'll come at the expense of minutes and especially starting minutes for Fox.
In a big way. And Fox has to, like, George Hill's fine, but George Hill isn't, like, a Hall of Famer. Like,
if you had, like, a
40-year-old Jason Kidd on your team,
yeah,
that's so different. Like, a guy learning behind a guy like that. Well, I don't that's necessarily want my rookie learning behind George Hill.
Not for Fox, but Z-Bo will be good for the younger bigs like Scal and Willie and others like that. That
dude, I think this is going to be a coming out season for Willie Cauley-Stein.
Well, it will be. And Scal,
I think he's going to be a candidate for most improved player of the year, whatever it's called.
It's possible.
I see that coming.
No, it's definitely possible. So, I don't know. It's just I need George Hill to be a mentor, and George Hill's too young to be take on that role like exclusively.
He just doesn't strike me as a guy who's like a mentor. Like I don't know.
No, he does. I think. I mean, maybe not as much as like an Andre Miller or Jason Kidd or something. But like I think he's.
Do you think he's a real high IQ player? Like I just that's what I guess I don't. It doesn't strike me as like a super high IQ guy.
I think he has too many good years left for him to like take on.
He's
that
not
going to
want to give up anything.
Yeah,
guy who was just drafted fifth overall, which
yeah.
Like, that's the thing with what the Bears are doing right now, where they just paid a guy $18 million to be their starting quarterback, and then they draft another guy number two overall. Like, they trade up to get a guy. Like, that kind of stuff, I don't think it's good for the locker room. Like, just bad news, Bears.
Now, you and I are on the same page, though, when it comes to Lonzo Ball. We are rooting for him to have the worst rookie season in point guard, like, for a point guard in NBA history, right? Like, that's...
We are absolutely doing that.
Okay, good. When it comes to baseball, though, go Dodgers. All right. So you want to talk ghost story? Are we done doing NBA?
Yeah, let's talk ghost story. Let's have a movie that we've both seen. And I don't want to give spoilers to how we felt about it, but I think we both enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yes. So let's talk about that. So for those of you listening, a ghost story is a film starring Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. It's directed by David Lowery, friend of the pod. For those of you who haven't listened, Skylar actually did an interview, a podcast episode here, Brave Little Ep, where he interviewed, 15 minutes roughly?
About 10 minutes, yeah. I think our episode's about 30 minutes. So.
Yeah, it's amazing. The commentary beforehand is about 20 minutes and the interview is like 10. But you were able to have an interview with him while he was doing kind of the press tour, the junket for A Ghost Story.
Yeah, he was in full junket mode.
Yeah. And so
I will say this as a little teaser. I think we're going to be able to have a about an hour and a half sit down with him in the next few months before he heads off on his next movie.
Ooh.
Because he's got a little bit of time. And so I have a non-verbal, like a verbal commitment that's non-tenured or anything. So we'll see.
I would love it if the commitment was nonverbal. Like if you were like, hey, dude, can we get you for an hour podcast? And he just nods.
He didn't nod. He kind of shrugged, which I took as a nonverbal agreement.
Like, basically, if he invites you to his home, you bring the mic, whether you talk about it beforehand or not, right?
Oh, no, I bring the mic taped to my chest.
Tape, exactly. You got to make sure he can't see it. I'll be outside in a van.
Which these blue mics are kind of big, but, you know, I'll tape it up and then
Yeti
underneath. Have a laptop taped to my back that it's plugged into and recording the whole time.
You bring the mic and be like, hey, you got 45 free minutes, 30 minutes? Try and negotiate and then go over.
Oh, no, no. I just start talking to him and just like, he doesn't even know we're recording it. That's the beauty of it all. And so, then before he knows it,
He lives in the Dallas area, which is obviously amazing.
Yeah, he lives in East Dallas. He's near White Rock Lake, right off the Santa Fe Trail, which
so lots of friends there. He directed a ghost story. He did Pete's Dragon last
year.
That's
his blockbuster.
That's his blockbuster.
It's a movie that like is a fantastic film. It was top five of the year. But like also somehow went kind of unnoticed generally in the sense that it didn't do boffo BO. Like it made its money back because they were very shrewd with how they spent on that film. They made it for very cheap. They got New Zealand to pay for a ton of it. And so they were able to turn a profit on a film that didn't make
Disney
a ton of money.
Spent very little marketing money, you know, relatively.
They did, because they were pushing for their other live-action film of the year, or of the summer, which was a Steven Spielberg flick, which, man, what are the odds that you're David Lowery as a kid, and you're like, someday I'll make a movie with the same studio in a summer with Steven Spielberg, and my movie will be amazing and critically acclaimed and do well, and his movie will be a bomb. Like, it's pretty wild to think about.
Which Spielberg film? Why am I forgetting?
Big freaking giant.
Oh, BFG. Oh, my gosh. I forgot that that was so... Oh, my gosh. Disney had those, too. Anyway.
Disney put their money in that pot. They said, let's go BFG.
They were trying to ride that Mark Rylance wave.
Yeah. So, they spent $65 million on Pete's Dragon. Now, $15 million of that was covered by the great people of New Zealand.
Wow.
And then the marketing budget was not anywhere near $65
million. No.
And so the $150 million it made worldwide is definitely green for Disney.
No, they went green, yeah.
So
so he directed Pete's Dragon. We've talked about Ain't Them Body Saints. He's written some films. Now, his next movie, he's already finished filming and they're editing right now. It's called Old Man and the Gun, which he wrote and directed. It's adapted from a novel.
Which it has one of the Pete's Dragon stars.
It sure does.
Who you may have heard of. He's kind of like...
Is he... Do a lot of people know who he is?
I actually made a pretty great joke with good old David Lowery when I was chatting with him. I said, what does it feel like when you kind of can have ownership over an actor? Like, you have an actor who's not really super big time, and then all of a sudden they blow up. Like, how does that feel? He's like, I guess I haven't really had that experience yet. Like, I haven't had an actor that I worked with who, like, really made it after that, if they weren't, like, doing really well before. And I was like, well, you got that guy, it was in Pete's Dragon, like, Rob Redford? And I got a good laugh out of him. So that was, like, that's a highlight for me.
Well, and it's speaking of that, having actors, in prep for this pod, you know, after having seen A Ghost Story, I went through a ton of YouTube clips of interviews with Lowery recently, you know, while he was on the press junket. And I can't tell you how many people asked some version of the question about, like, how did you get Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara? Man. Almost kind of like, who are you?
In the Q&A I had with him, the same question came up. And it's just so annoying. It's so, like, talking down to him. It's terrible.
Oh, I know. And he handles it with so much grace and class. Like,
he's the classiest person there is.
He's really classy. Like, I watched this cringy interview where this dude, it was like 15 minutes long, and he asks him what every little thing means in a ghost story. Like, when the ghost does this, what does that mean? You know, and it's like this stuff that's like, no, you don't ask artists what every single tiny little moment actually is supposed to mean literally. Like, that's not what you do.
Dude, Q&As are the worst thing about the movie industry.
Oh, yeah.
They're the worst thing about film festivals.
Yes, they are.
They are all terrible. I've never been to a Q&A where a question was asked that I was like, I'm really glad that was asked. It's just all the questions suck.
Yep.
If they were smart, they would have the writer or like the stars, whoever the director, whoever it is, write out answers and then just have plants and ask those questions, because the audience questions are always terrible.
Oh, I ever have a film that goes to Sundance.
I've never had a good experience. Although the best one I might have had was that time I got to sit next to David Arquette and watch a terrible film he had that premiered at the Dallas Film Festival.
Courtney Cox's ex-husband, yeah.
Yes, and he shared some like chocolate candy and popcorn with me. And then he went up and people were like, what was it like being in a movie that was that terrible? He's like, we didn't know it on set. And, like, it was just really a chill Q&A afterwards.
Dude, David Arquette, Eight-Legged Freaks, underrated movie.
Eight-Legged Freaks, and What is Eight-Legged Freaks? It makes me think of that one movie. The symbol is a smiley face, but like...
Evolution.
Evolution.
That's right. How did I know that? Wow.
Dude, it's really weird that you knew that, but like...
It is weird that I knew that.
Vivid memory, a sky fact about me, is that I went to see that movie with my next door neighbor, and I remember sitting in the back of their like tiny little pickup truck that had like a second row, but like not for adults, just for tiny kids. And it came out in like 01, so I would have been like 13, too big for that row.
An old movie.
But his parents were big smokers, and it smelled terrible in that truck. And that's all I could think of during the whole movie is like, God, that truck smelled like smoke.
Like, anyway. You're talking tobacco, or are you talking hot box? Like,
no, some tobacco. I would have been like, well, that smelled fine. But yeah, David Duchovny. I don't know why I think of David Arquette.
Yeah, well, I knew exactly what you meant. Like, I had made that connection. They both have David Arquette.
Does that ever make you wish that David Reitman had died in the year 2000?
Who?
David Reitman, the director of Evolution and Ghostbusters.
He died in 2000?
No, I'm saying I wish he would have died in 2000. Oh, yeah, he's still alive. No. Oh, yeah, but he would have died in 2000. We would have had to watch Evolution. So.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, well, really, what has he delivered to us since then? He produced Draft Day, I guess? Like, that's cool.
I realize this is pretty tangential. Where this had started from, though, was that Old Man and the Gun is David Lowery's next movie. Oh, man. Isn't that incredible? We really got down a path. It's been a while since we potted.
Woo!
That was worth it, though. Worth it. But Old Man and the Gun comes out next year. You know, like I said, it's already been wrapped. It's already wrapped filming. They're editing it. But it's starring Robert Redford, Elizabeth Moss, Casey Affleck again, Sissy Spacek, and Danny Glover, a bunch of other people. But Rob, I heard in an interview, Lowery said that Redford brought the script to him, or the story, the book. I mean, he brought the book to him and said he's been wanting to adapt this into a movie, and it's about an old man who had, you know, was a bank robber and escaped a bunch of prisons and yada, yada. Honestly, I'm pumped for the movie.
But, have you seen screenshots or like on-set pictures? Yeah. It looks incredible. Like,
it looks great.
It's a period piece.
It looks really good.
It's a great time period. Like, it looks awesome. I'm very excited gonna be for great. It. Plus, Lowery has yet to lead us astray in any way, shape, or form.
And honestly, we're going to get him back on during that press junket, and we're going to talk to him about it.
Oh, absolutely.
So, by then, we might be BFFs. Now, you emailed our podcast interview with him. You emailed it to him to make sure that he knew that we did it. We posted it, and he listened to it. Now, you told me that you had an email correspondence with him. This is not fake news. This is not a bit. This is real. I made some predictions on that pod. Predictions I've been making for a while about how I think that Disney at some point is going to offer a Star Wars film to Lowery to direct, probably sooner than later. You know, I would guess within the next 3 years. He heard that on the pod. Now, I know you can't tell me the details of the conversation, okay? We don't want to ruin the confidence here. He is a friend of the pod. What's your sense on how he responded to my prediction about him directing a Star Wars film?
The way you asked that. Yeah, I can't go too much into it because I do want to respect like his privacy on it and stuff. Like,
but he heard my prediction.
I want to keep that cool.
But he acknowledged that he heard that prediction.
He acknowledged it, yeah. I mean, I would say...
Now, did he acknowledge it unprovoked? Like that was a response that he had?
I think it was part of the conversation we were having. Mm. But I mean, I would say keep watching his career over the next few, like the next decade. And I think he's going to be doing a lot of cool things.
Okay.
It's public knowledge that he's working on a Peter Pan script right now.
Mm-hmm.
Him and Toby, his co-writer. And I'm really excited about what that script's going to look like and whether or not he's going to direct that. But I mean, like, the man has a lot of opportunities ahead of him. He's like, the crazy thing is that he's still living in Dallas, but he's a really hot property. Like, you work with Disney and things are going really well for you. So he's a hot commodity in the city of Hollywood, despite him living in Dallas. So him and Shane Carruth are working to build like Dallas as our little,
that's great,
cool place. Like, I don't know. Everyone thinks of Austin as being, the liberal city in Texas, but here we are in Dallas
Here you are in Dallas bringing down Confederate monuments and rising up indie filmmakers. It's really actually.
And the crazy thing is, he was indie, but now, like, he did Pete's Dragon, man. Like, the guy.
So
So that's a good segue to Ghost Story, right? Like,
yeah.
Here's a guy who does Peace Dragon as his last film, and then comes in and does a Ghost Story, which has these two huge Hollywood names as the two leads. So it's like marketable in that sense. It's got like a really cool visual. Like the poster's great. A24 killed it with that. The trailer's really great. Like, I think it's all there. But it's a super high-minded, not super sure it's super accessible to a general audience. Like,
no, not at all. And this is not a movie that... they from the very beginning, they financed this independently. They didn't even attempt to sell it to a studio or anything.
Right.
I mean, for a lot of reasons why they... but, like, if you were a studio head, I mean, I can say for me, I wouldn't touch this movie. Like,
right, but... A24, not only did they buy it, they paid a pretty handsome amount for it.
I guess major studio is what I mean, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, it's true. But like after they bought it, what I'm saying is like, it's interesting A24 paid the amount they did for it, and then they put the money into marketing it that they did. And then ultimately it's kind of strange because they put the money into it, and they put it into a lot of markets at first, and like they were putting like raising the theater count, and then out of nowhere, like they killed the theater count. And... it was like doing pretty well, like the numbers looked good, but and then they kind of gave up on it like really fast.
I mean, I don't think the per number, the math wasn't totally working to keep it as many.
The per theater for a couple weeks, it had the highest per theater of
early on. It did
of the big movies, like or of any movie, like when it had like 20, 30 theaters even, which is not terrible. But like, I mean, it did $1.5 million domestic, which sounds
does it list
tiny.
The budget? On
budget was $100,000.
That's what it says on there?
Yeah, A24 paid a lot more than that.
$1,000.
Yeah. Which, so, I mean, they had to tear down a house for this movie.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, that's most of the budget goes into said house, but...
So, I have so many things I want to say. I got a lot of notes.
Let's go into it.
I have... This movie is something truly remarkable. You had mentioned he came off of Pete's Dragon doing this. I think a lot of people would view this... if they saw kind of all the pieces as like kind of his way of like working on this big, huge, high, you know, big budget Hollywood blockbuster type movie. And then he wants to do something super, super small and personal. Right. Which may or may not have some truth in it. But I was listening to an interview with him and he just straight up says like, this is not like a one for them, one for us type of scenario that's like super reductive. He said that he personally likes both movies equally. Pete's Dragon and A Ghost Story.
Dude, he's so proud of Pete's Dragon.
Oh, he should be.
No,
it was
I
the
love
most
that.
Underrated like, film of last year, easily.
And it's great because I feel like somebody... That's the weird thing about David Lowery, if I can just go off a little bit. David Lowery is a vegan. He is a guy who directed Ain't the Body Saints. He wrote and directed A Ghost Story. Like, he's this guy who obviously thinks about things in a very intellectual, high-minded way. And I feel like that can be kind of off-putting in a way because it can almost be like, oh, here's... another one of these like elitists who thinks
like
they're better than...
like a pretentious hipster.
A pretentious hipster. Like, pretentious is a great word for what you might think it is. But it is not the case. Because this guy is the opposite of pretentious, in fact. He is incredibly cool. And it's really strange to talk to this person who you're expecting to be ready to just talk about who knows what. But he wants to talk about Star Wars or like Indiana Jones or like, I don't know. He's just a guy who loves movies. And he also loves thinking about time and space and where we belong in the world and stuff like that. And so it's like he definitely isn't going to be watching or writing for the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like he can make stuff that I think appeals to a big chunk of the country. Like A Ghost Story, like we said, it's not going to appeal to everybody. But I think people who are listening to this podcast would definitely enjoy it. Like,
yeah.
It has that kind of appeal.
Talking about Lowry. It's rare to have an artist like him that he fits kind of the stereotypical mold of this pretentious kind of hipster artist type, like without an ego and this huge amount of accessibility, which I felt like when we went to a Sundance Q&A, I felt like when you did the interview with him, any interview I've watched with him, this guy's like incredibly gracious, down to earth, not condescending at all. But what's fascinating about that is that he's going to be able to make both indie as well as mainstream content with this artistic voice that's going to be so fascinating to watch because I do think he can tap in. I don't think he's so like kind of barricaded off from like the general public view of things, right? Like, I don't think he's this high-minded hipster that
he's not. No, like he's not too good to direct a Pete's Dragon, right, or like even
right.
And so like a big so budget film.
Like I said, he said he likes both of these movies equally. He said both are just as personal to him, which is amazing considering A Ghost Story feels like one of the most personal things I've ever watched. So the moniker, or I should say the caveat I should give at the very, very beginning here is the very beginning, not the beginning, but the caveat with this review is that this is the quintessential movie like that you wouldn't recommend to your parents, right? Like my parents, my parents would hate this movie.
I think most people over 50 would hate this movie.
It is the example of an artist that's given complete control to do whatever they want and to make it like it is the definition of like art house indie experimental type filmmaking. The difference here between this and a lot of other stuff I see at Sundance that's super high minded is that this works in a way, honestly, unlike any other indie film that I've seen, certainly in recent memory.
Like, I think a good movie to compare this to, which I actually talked with David about on the night that I saw it, is Tree of Life.
Totally.
And I think this is way more accessible than Tree of Life is.
It is a better film than the Tree of Life.
It's a better film than Tree of Life. And let's get into spoilers a little bit, because I just want to be able to talk about things. So if you haven't seen it...
What spoiler? What type of spoilers? Because everyone listening has not seen it.
That's a good point.
So spoilers are only for like, us.
Yeah, I mean, just because... So in Tree of Life, it goes back into prehistoric times. Like,
I think we can dinosaurs. Talk scenes without it being really spoiled.
Okay, so it talks about prehistoric times. There's dinosaurs that walk by and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's very disconnected from the story. But what Lowry managed to do was to do something similar. He travels through time non-linearly. Yeah. And he like stays in the same location, but through time. And it is part of the story. In fact, he manages to weave things into that that connects everything together and makes it one story that's hyper interesting.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah.
It's that part of it felt so much more interesting than Tree of Life, which like Tree of Life is so high minded. It's one of those movies where you get out, you're like, you want to tell people you liked it because you don't want to seem like you didn't get it.
But Tree of Life is flawed. It's high minded to such a flaw.
Yeah. And Sean Penn's a real, anyway.
Yeah.
But like this, everything has a purpose. And like maybe it's just that I get David Lowery more than I get Terrence Malick or whatever, but like it just all made sense. And like it's all like this really cohesive idea. And
it is such a man. So I was like live texting you and Aaron while I was watching this. Both of you had seen it. You know, I was really nervous going in. I love David Lowery. I love Rooney Mara. I love Casey Affleck. I love the idea of what he's trying to do, but I was so scared that this would be such this inaccessible piece of art that was just so bizarre that I just couldn't really get behind it. I mean, a lot of times I'll like this stuff. Sometimes I won't. I was so afraid of seeing a film that by David Lowery that I wasn't going to enjoy. But right away, it struck me in so many ways, primarily because of the music. Which is outstanding throughout. But like, it's not a spoiler to say that this is a film with Casey Affleck, Rooney Mara. There's limited dialogue. I mean, there is definitely talking. But right up, you know, it's towards the beginning of the film, Casey Affleck's character passes away. You can get that from the trailers. That's not a spoiler. And the rest of the movie, you know, the movie portrays, you know, his afterlife. He's a ghost in a literal sheet, which seems like such a silly joke. And in anyone else's hands, any other director's hands, it would have felt silly and he wouldn't have been able to pull it off. But it's such a balancing act that you see the perspective of this ghost sticking around this house that they had been living in. And a lot of the theme of this film is about learning to let go in life, what it means to move on, the things that we hold on to. And it starts to play, like you were talking about, with this timeline, like Tree of Life, to where it no longer becomes totally linear, and it starts to go into some really, really interesting places. And then after you don't hear conversation for a while, there's this random scene with an individual, this character that's giving a monologue kind of at a party, that is both hilarious and funny and indulgent.
Let's wrap this all up under the blanket of someone thinking, this is something that they'll remember me for. And they did, and we do. And sure enough, we do what we can to endure. We build our legacy piece by piece, and maybe the whole world will remember you, or maybe just a couple of people, but you do what you can to make sure you're still around after you're gone. And so, we're still reading this book. We're still singing a song. Kids remember their parents and their grandparents. And everyone's got their family tree, and Beethoven's got his symphony, and we've got it too. And everyone will keep listening to it for the foreseeable future, but that's where things start breaking down, because your kids... Do you have kids? Wait. Who here has kids? You, your kids are gonna die. Yours too. Hey, just saying, they're all gonna die. And their kids will die, and so on and so on. And then there's gonna be one big tectonic shift. Yosemite will blow, and the Western plates will shift, and the oceans will rise, the mountains will fall, and 90% of humanity will be gone. One fell swoop. This is just science.
Oh, absolutely. It was him writing it to have his statement out there.
That's exactly right, yeah. And gosh, on paper, this movie shouldn't work. This movie on paper shouldn't be good. I shouldn't have enjoyed it. I was so blown away with this film. I will say, David Lowery sets up these shots, okay, that he sits still, the camera. It's not panning, it's not moving, for minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, in a couple of cases. There's a couple early on that I'm sitting there like, he hasn't moved the camera even a little bit. Like, I'm not talking about a continuous shot that's moving. We've seen a lot of people do that. It's kind of the gimmick from Birdman. I'm talking about a stationary shot,
right,
on a tripod.
And like, honestly, I think you see this in other kind of indie movies, like non-mainstream films. But I feel like there was a purpose each time.
Totally.
And it wasn't just aimless. And like, for example, the scene in the morgue is one of the coolest scenes
that's right.
I've ever seen in a movie in my entire life.
Yeah.
And like, that's why I wish everybody could have seen this movie in the theaters, because I think that chance has really gone away now. So I think it's playing very few theaters now, if it's anywhere. I don't know.
The morgue scene in particular, the camera sits there so long that it gets to the point where you're like, it feels a little bit awkward and then uncomfortable, to the point where you feel like you're watching something that you shouldn't be, like, you know, like you're having a view into something that you're not supposed to be.
Right.
Like,
and the thing that would suck about watching this movie at home is, if you had your phone in your hand, and like in a scene like that, you'd probably be like, okay, I can look down and check what, like, I check my text or whatever. But that's the exact moment where being in a theater is amazing, because you just keep watching and you keep watching, and it pays off so well. Like,
oh, it does. In fact, don't watch it on the TV and have your phone nearby you. Watch this movie on your phone. The aspect ratio is built so that, you know, it'll fit great vertical.
Yeah, just watch it vertically.
And that way you won't be distracted by your phone. Turn off notifications, airplane mode.
Oh, that's good.
Download the movie, airplane mode, watch it. You don't want to watch this distracted. This isn't in the background type of movie, right? Like, you want to be paying attention. But the second scene, the famous scene famous scene coming out of Sundance, people were complaining about. We've talked about it on the pod. There is a scene where Rooney Mara eats, you know, most of, you know, I believe a cherry pie.
A pie from a restaurant that's just down the road from me. So next time you're in Dallas, we can go get a pie from there.
It's like a Marie Callender's?
The Spiral. No, it's a vegan restaurant, actually.
Well, what's incredible about where it came from, by the way, and I do think this was somewhat profound, or at least interesting, is that this was something that, you know, someone had brought by as kind of a condolences, you know, because of the loss of her husband. And she has the scene where she just starts eating it. In this scene, which seems silly to describe, had such a weird emotional and physical response from me, because it sits there for a long time as she's chowing down kind of more and more aggressively. And this is a woman that's going through a grieving process. Something so traumatic happened recently that you can tell that she's trying to do something physically that will just keep her from crying, right? Like, just that will keep her from doing anything else. And she feels like maybe just eating and eating and eating this will keep her from breaking down. And it's this weirdly emotional experience for me. And one of the interviews I was listening to with Lowery, people, of course, everyone asks him about it, but this is what he says when asked about the pie scene and like why he did that, like if it was just that kind of shock factor. And he straight up says that that scene's probably his favorite thing he's ever made. Is that single scene. His favorite thing he's ever made. I thought it was like It sounds silly. I thought it was incredible.
No, I mean, I think it's great. Like, it's bold in a way. Like, I mean, I think the fact that people dislike it or, like, there's people that hate it only stands to, like, show how great it is, because if it was, like, universally acclaimed, it'd be like, yeah, mm-hmm. well, what's wrong with it? Like,
the audience score for this movie is not high.
It's not high because, I mean, that's where critics are... there's critics who are smarter than your general audience. There's some critics that are stupid, but
it's got 91%, right? It's still 90, certified.
I think higher, maybe 91, but it's definitely it's his highest movie yet. Like it's, and he's on a progression where he's going up. Like I think Ain't Them Bodies was in the high 70s, 79, yeah. And then Pete's Dragon was like 87, which is huge for a Disney film like that.
Oh yeah,
and so now he's in the 90s, like just on his way up.
So. One other quick scene I want to talk about, I thought was like, again, would be silly on paper, but in the hands of David Lauer, he made compelling, is Casey Affleck's ghost character walks by a window at one point and sees another ghost in a sheet at the neighbor's house through the window. And they look at each other and they stare at each other and they have a conversation that's done through subtitles. Mm-hmm. And the person in the, you know, the neighbor ghost in subtitles says, "I'm waiting for someone."
Who was played by Lady Gaga, by the way.
It cuts over to Casey Affleck, and he says, "Who?" And it goes back to the neighbor ghost, and they say, "I don't remember." And it's devastating and plays into that theme of, like, you know, holding on to things we shouldn't be and letting go when we should, and the idea that this person's clearly so dedicated to waiting for something that they don't, for someone that they don't even remember. It was, like, again, really silly if I read that in a script, but profounded it, you know, or executed in a profound way here. I was just floored the whole time, all the way up to the very end, from beginning to end. It is undoubtedly a high-minded piece of art, but one that it got me hook, line, and sinker. One of my favorite films of the year, and I really wasn't expecting that. I'd really try to figure out after I saw the movie why I had such a positive response to it. And part of it is this for me. Like, I made little movies growing up. I still make movies now. Obviously nothing professionally. In a perfect world, like, I would have loved to have been a filmmaker in my career, right? I never actually tried to do that. I think it was, like, never a realistic scenario.
It's so hard.
You can be the best filmmaker in the world and still not make a living doing it. So,
for sure.
And so, like, I the pragmatic part of me just didn't allow it to happen. And so my goal has always been to, like, you know, follow the career path that I want to, do things that are interesting and that I like, which I'm currently doing, and hopefully be able to have maybe enough money or time or resources to make an amateur film here and there, whether it's the Rasimo documentary or a small little short with some friends. Like, Aaron and I did this film in Los Angeles called Swindle several years back, right? Like, I was happy to help Aaron be a part of that. Like, I would love it if I could be able to do that for the rest of my life, making little things. But, like, expressions of how I feel. Like, I remember when I first lived in New York, and I remember feeling all of these weird emotions and things about living there, thinking I wanted to make a movie that captured it. But in my head, I was like, I don't know what I would do with it. And I don't know if anyone would ever watch it, right? Like, no one would probably watch it. And I feel like a ghost story is something super personal to Lowry. Mm-hmm. To the point that this is a guy making real money, you know, now making Hollywood money, making Pete's Dragon. In the middle of editing it, he is flying back on the weekends from Los Angeles to Dallas to start setting up the production for a ghost story, for which he gets two Academy Award nominated, well, one winner, one nominated actors, to work for free without seeing a script, having no idea if it'll be a short film.
Just from a text message from him. A single text.
You just got a text message from Lowry?
No, I'm saying that's all he did was he just texted them.
Oh, yeah, that was enough. He texted Affleck and yeah. But I was listening to interviews with Affleck and Rooney, and they said that, like, the expectations on set was, you know, I have this idea, it might not work, and so we might scrap everything. We might work on, they shot it in 16 days. They said, you know, there was a scenario where it was, if it didn't work, he wouldn't ever show it to anybody. And to be able to work under those circumstances is incredible. And of course, in order to do that, you have to self-finance, right? So Lowry puts up the money, $100,000, you know, dollar budget, it sounds like. They find a house that's going to be demoed that they can use. He gets these incredible actors to work for free. Amazing. And so right after he makes Pete's Dragon, he has his opportunity, which is not easy to do. It is not easy to work for something that will likely not make you money. And to get all these people involved and to be able to execute on that creative vision at that level of which he does, something that was not commercial in any way, shape, or form, just shows like this dude is a true American filmmaker. This guy's a creative force. And I just don't think there are very many people on this planet who could execute on an idea and a vision like that without the resources. Like most people would have just quit when they couldn't get a studio to finance it, right?
Right.
Or couldn't get the right actors or couldn't, you know, whatever. This dude made this happen while he was finishing up the biggest film of his life at that point, and is able to make that movie. Like, it's just remarkable to me. It's
incredible, and he deserves so much credit, and it's a shame that more people didn't get their hands on this. Like, I wish everyone who's like really into movies could see this, because I get that this will get zero Oscar buzz whatsoever, and it's unfortunate because I feel like it'd be a cool movie to get that kind of buzz, but it won't. But like, yeah, there's performances in this. I think Rooney Mara definitely deserves a nom.
Rooney Mara is definitely the hero. I mean, she was the highlight.
Which is funny because like, if this was a big movie, like an Oscar baity movie, I bet the Oscars would love to give Casey Affleck a nomination in a movie where the majority of the film he's under a sheet. Like, they would love that. That's such an Oscars thing to do.
Yes.
But because it doesn't come out the right time and it's not the right film, like, they just would never do it.
It's not a movie that Academy Award voters are going to watch on screener. They're just not going to watch this movie.
No.
They're not going to do it. So, in the most David Lowery way, he responded to this question about why did you make this film? His response was, I had this idea. I felt like I had the capacity. And then I had a window of time.
Yep.
And that was it.
Yeah. And I mean, that's just, he uses his time very well.
Yep. There's a pretty sweet shot of downtown Dallas in this movie.
There is. They kind of futurized. Can you see from your window Dallas.
Where that place is, where they filmed?
That's on the north side of downtown. I'm on the south side. So.
You're south side.
Yeah, that was uptown looking downtown. So.
I see.
The building that they shot from was actually in uptown technically, but. So yeah, it's
you weren't on our pod when we did the top five films of the year so far.
Right, I wasn't there for that.
Where do you put then? Now's your chance to tell me where you put A Ghost Story.
Man, like right now, it's definitely top five. I'm just trying to think of what movies have come out this year that I've seen.
It's up there for Dunkirk. It's up there with Dunkirk for me. Like, I don't know where I'd put them right now.
Oh, but like, I love Dunkirk. I really enjoyed. I'm just looking at the list now. I'm not seeing anything I enjoyed more than this. Like, I loved Baby Driver. I really enjoyed Dunkirk. I really enjoyed Logan. Guardians Volume 2.
Yep.
Logan was fun. Wonder Woman was a really impressive movie.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure there's anything that was better than this. Oh, wait, The Mummy. Yeah, The Mummy.
Oh, that's right. Tom Cruise had a movie.
Can't forget The Mummy.
That's everyone, for sure.
No, I think there's probably only going to be one movie that passes this for me this year. Or maybe there's two movies that have the potential. Last but Jedi. I think Thor Ragnarok has a real potential to be my favorite movie of the year. It probably has a very good potential to be my favorite Marvel film of the year.
We're looking forward
Marvel
to that
film ever.
Wow.
Oh, the trailer is nothing short of the perfect
All signs
trailer.
Are good so far, for sure.
Oh, Taika. And then the news that 80% of the movie was just ad-libbed on set. That makes me
crazy.
So happy. Do you remember we podcasted about that?
Yeah.
And you guys were like, no, that's
you're
not
concerned?
Right. Like, that doesn't make any sense. And I said, no, Taika, he loves that. And you guys were like,
no,
that didn't
happen. They wouldn't let Phil Lord and Christopher Miller do that. I mean, granted, that's Lucasfilm, not Marvel, but still owned by Disney.
You have to give the Marvel people credit. They let Taika make a Taika movie.
Do I, though? Because the Edgar Wright stuff.
Yeah, but Edgar Wright obviously just didn't know how to play them. Like, Taika got this done.
Oh, wow. Wow.
How did he?
Marvel said.
No, I mean, like, how did Taika do this?
I don't know. I don't know. I think they had no. I mean, he obviously didn't ask permission to do that, but they knew what they were getting.
No, I think that's the thing is they knew they were getting Taika and they wanted Taika. Like they
can't,
saw.
You can't watch Hunt for the Wilder People and think like this is a director we can control.
Man, it's incredible. That, like, because they didn't even get to see Wilder People before they picked him.
You don't think they saw got to see a version of it?
No, I think that they picked him off What We Do in the Shadows.
And Boy.
Yeah, or like Eagle vs Shark. Like he's got a pretty impressive filmography already.
Eagle vs Shark's okay, but yeah.
Yeah, when I saw Eagle vs Shark as like a 19-year-old, I was very put off by it.
Yeah, the rest of his filmography is good.
No, he's a transcendent talent, and he's an incredibly funny comedic actor, and I am so excited to see what he can do with this. Like, man, just pictures on set, cast photos with him. Like, the cast, it's the best cast that's been in any Marvel movie. I mean, it's got Goldblum.
I'm excited. I doubt I will like it more than a Ghost Story, though. I'll tell you that.
Oh, I think I'll probably be watching Thor Ragnarok for the next 10 years. Dude, you don't know how many times I've watched Hunt for the Wilder People.
Did you only see a Ghost Story once?
I've only seen it once.
Because when you're an instant react, we're all subject to recency bias, but your initial reaction to that movie was like, you were so blown away. I'll never forget.
It's incredibly impressive. Like, I love it, but.
You said it was the best movie of the year at that point.
And I stand by that. It's still the best movie of the year I've seen.
Yeah, right. And that was pre a bunch of movies.
Baby and I haven't even seen Thor Ragnarok. It might be terrible, but the trailer for Thor Ragnarok is probably my favorite thing I've ever seen.
We need to recognize we have an audience of people here that will literally 100% of them haven't seen it. I think we can promise that this will be one of the most unique film experiences you will ever have.
Absolutely.
Whether you like it or not, will be, I can't say.
It's incredibly thoughtful. It's interesting. You get Rooney Mara, you get Casey Affleck, you get a lot of cool little performances. You'll think about it. I can guarantee you'll think about it for a while after.
You might not. It's not going to be the most rewatchable movie.
I want to rewatch it, but like mostly just to.
I do too.
See things that I missed, but like.
Right. That's why.
Yeah,
but it's not gonna like play something on cable, you'll like over and over. It's not like
you'll have friends over and you're like, you know what you guys would love to watch.
Yeah, it's not a party movie. You just pop in a Ghost Story.
Yeah, that's what Hunt for the Wilder People is, by the way.
But true cinephiles, people who really enjoy the power of film. This is the type of movie you want to check out. Now, there was, I'm going to pull it up right now. And this is kind of my wrap up. And I'm going to pull up a quote from Peter Travers, the Rolling Stone, in his review that really captures exactly how I feel. And while I'm doing that, do you want to kind of give your final wrap up thoughts, bits about the movie?
It's a great movie. I wouldn't recommend anyone go see it, but I feel like anybody who's listening to this podcast should go see it.
Right.
Except Robbie Tripp.
Yeah. Hey, Robbie, don't go see this movie.
Yeah, Robbie, you're not going to like it. It's not going to conform to your real conservative ideals. But everyone else, go see it. Robbie, go jump in a lake.
No. Yes, on a hot day, jump in a cool lake with your wife.
Yeah, cool off. Enjoy it. With your thick wife. Thick life wife. Ooh, thick wife life. Now, there's a shirt, Robbie. Hashtag thick wife life.
We can't talk about this.
We can talk about this. Don't you dare take this out. I'm walking out of the podcast.
I won't take it out. I won't take it out. Good. Just don't go any further.
Thick wife life. Stop. Anyway, I'll just end it there. I loved it.
Okay. All right. So here's the... It's in Peter Travers in his review for the Rolling Stone. Kind of similar. He says, like, some people, like, aren't going to like this. This isn't for everyone. Let's see here. Yeah, this is how he puts it. If the sight of newly minted Oscar winner Casey Affleck scurrying around with a bedsheet over his head sounds more like a farce than deep feeling cinema, then feel free to skip A Ghost Story. If, however, you want to see what writer-director David Lowery can do with nothing but unfettered imagination and an unabiding faith in the possibilities of movies, then trust us. This is a poetic and profound experiment that you do not want to miss.
Boom.
That's pretty good.
That's really good. I like that a lot.
Yeah. It the whole like unfettered imagination and abiding faith in the possibilities of movies. Like it's an experience. And I encourage you to experience it.
Must be so cool to like make a film like this and be able to go see a review like that and just be like, I know that David doesn't do it for the reviews, but I feel like that just has to be awesome to see people who get it.
Well, we read him some reviews in our you did in the interview.
Yeah, he was really good at telling which was for Ghost and which was for Ghost Story.
Yeah. I was surprised how easy that was.
Yeah, he's good at it, but Man, good to be back on the pod. I'm dealing with a little bit of a cold here, but...
You feeling okay?
Under the weather, but well, it's one of those summertime...
It's midnight where you are right now, so go back and get some rest. Down some NyQuil.
Appreciate you, pal. Love you, buddy.
Hey, love you too, man. Are you running late? Did you see too much? All the awful dreams felt real enough. Did you know that she waking up? Did she die in the night? Leave you alone. Mirror, mirror, is your crooked nose boring here? A thousand recalls, no children, just emptiness, no place like home. Hold on to your butts.